72. And in fact, we might hold Amendment Number 7 till tomorrow if you want, unless somebody has feelings about it. This eliminates all cash contributions.
I've heard the objections are that in real rural areas, they don't deal in checks. Cash is about the only form, and it does give a problem out there. I just heard that. I agree with it, and I'll even vote for it, but I hear it is a problem out there.
How about postal money orders or cashier's checks? Are those a hassle?
Yes.
Senator Halford?
What about, I mean, would this apply if you had a spaghetti feed fundraiser and it was a $30 event?
Susan?
I'm sorry, I didn't know
this point.
If you had a spaghetti feed fundraiser and it was, you know, $25 or $30 ahead to come to a spaghetti feed political fundraiser.
Bring your checkbook or you don't get in the door.
So this would have...
I think it probably would. I assume that when you do the spaghetti feeds and so on,
well,
you know, if you report those contributions as contributions and the expenses
so you have to
as...
have receipts and everything. Normally
yeah.
What you do now is you have receipts for... And everybody gets a receipt back, and then you turn the receipts into your campaign account and account those with the cash.
Sure, but the money is considered a contribution, and this amendment would mean that people would have to give you checks for your spaghetti feed, or your pizza feed, for that matter.
See, I get checks, Senator Ferguson.
There was a survey that I heard about in Eagle River where 18% of the people out there don't have checking accounts. I haven't done this in the rural areas, but I suspect it's quite high. But has anybody thought about using credit cards?
Credit cards should be fine.
Sure, credit cards would be great.
I mean, what we had talked about was a sort of negotiable instrument, and in
right.
a sense, the credit card slip that you sign is a negotiable instrument
right.
of sorts.
Could you have a campaign, a person on a campaign that would have, like a business?
If you want it.
Go for an American Express.
Wouldn't that be neat? I hadn't even thought of that. Senator Ferguson, that's an excellent idea. This amendment has not been moved. Do you want to wait for tomorrow to move?
Yeah, I agree with your goal, but I think it would be difficult for things like spaghetti food.
See, I don't get cash. I get checks, and it's $10 checks or $15 checks or the $25 spaghetti fee checks. And I think that's the way it should be.
I would, too, if I were in your seat.
But you get the phone book.
The alternative is make an exception for that kind of a fundraiser.
I think you're right. It's wonderful.
Okay, we will hold this over. This has been so much fun this morning. We'll hold over the bill tomorrow. We'll go to the amendments. Susan, I need to see you and Mr. Bradley.
Okay.
And meeting adjourned until tomorrow morning at 8:30.
Thank you again, Susan, for your ass. Did you knock?
$30 for 30 days.
Good morning, everyone. Let's call the Finance Committee meeting to order, please. Let the record show we do have a quorum. The first bill up is Senate Bill 209, an act creating the Alaska State Fire Commission. They have one spokesman on the bill. The order of appearance this morning, or the agenda is before you. We will spend a few minutes on Senate Bill 209, 30 seconds on House Bill 382, about 30 minutes discussing amendments, if we can, on 356, and if we don't finish that, we will hold that over. We will be spending about 30 minutes, if possible, on the energy bills, and then we'll have the remainder of the session today on tort reform, Senate Bill 377. Senate Bill 209 is an act creating the Alaska State Fire Commission. There is a proposed CS in your packets and a new fiscal note in your packets. Senator Sackett, do you wish to take testimony immediately, or do you wish to just say a few words about the bill?
Okay, I was ready to move it out, but is the Senator's interest here?
There is one gentleman who wishes to testify on the bill, sir.
Let's move it out.
Senator Ferguson?
Senator Zingler indicated to me that he wouldn't come up and speak on this bill.
He talked to me yesterday and a couple of days before.
Is he in support of it?
Yes, he is, very much. Okay. Senator Ferguson, you have brought to my attention the fact that I told Senator Ziegler we'd do it at 9 o'clock. So why don't we hold the bill? When Senator Ziegler comes in, we will take this bill up. How's that?
Chairperson?
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Who else is going to testify?
One gentleman at the end of the table there is going to testify in support of the bill.
I'm ready to move it out.
Okay. House Bill 382.
Yeah.
House Bill 382, Senator Eliason. Let me tell the members of the committee what we've done on House Bill 382. We've given you a new committee substitute in your packet incorporating the changes we made in the bill the last three times we've talked about the bill. And Jens, I don't see my new CS.
Fourth 24th. Is that the new one?
382, 424 version, yes. 424 version incorporates the amendments we've adopted thus far. Senator Eliason.
Madam Chair, in this new committee substitute, does it contain the concern we had relative to the penalty clause if somebody comes back into the system? Okay, fine. That was one of my concerns. The other concern, of course, was Senator Cotulla and I have an amendment which would, in that effect, the amendment would put the teachers, the eligibility for teachers' retirement at the same time that the state employees would be eligible to retire. I think this is going to have a dramatic effect upon the tax structure in our communities. It's going to be a direct effect on the foundation program. It's going to have a direct effect on participation in the as far as it relates to the communities. It might even result in a decrease in tax. So
this is the amendment.
Amendment's before you.
Senator, does everyone have the amendment before them to 382? It looks like this. It's in your area. It's not in your packet. It's next to it somewhere. It's not in your packet. It'll be a loose piece of paper. Senator,
here's
yours right here by Eliason and Cotulla. Does everybody have it? Okay.
It's a half-a-page amendment, Madam Chair, but what it really does is puts the teachers on the same level for retirement eligibility as the state employees.
Senator Cotulla?
We feel jointly that it would provide an earlier acknowledgement of the retirement for those that wish to retire if, in fact, they meet the conditions suggested in the law. But also, this particular legislation I've spoke to, or particular amendment I spoke to the leadership, some of the leadership of the teachers, and they will let the teachers' groups know that if there's an impact on the machinery of the department administration, not to be getting hostile about it, to just to wait their turn, because it will impact it. And we don't expect more hires, but we just expect them to recognize that this isn't like missing a check. This is going to take some time, or we're going to, otherwise it's truly going to cost the state money. So if they're trying to save the state money and get this program in time, they'll be on board for it as the computer can work out. And I've been assured that the teachers would be informed that they are not to be raising a lot of cane because they're coming out a little later than they hope with their checks.
Senator Eliason, will you move the amendment so we have it before us for discussion?
I move the amendment, Madam Chair.
The amendment is moved,
Senator.
You asked for unanimous consent?
Yes.
There was discussion, Senator Eliason. Could you hold that unanimous consent? Senator Halford?
Yeah, I think I also support the amendment, but I'm concerned, just as Senator Cotulla is, that we don't have immediate constituent complaints because we can't get it done fast enough. But I think the amendment's a great idea.
Senator,
I'm sure we also checked with the retirement division over in Department Administration, and they did concede it would create an added workload to them, of course. But I think that they have the ability to handle it. They'd rather do it this way than put the teachers ahead of the state employees. So, but I think the reality of the situation is that the teachers will probably be retired before the state employees, but it'll all be processed at the same time.
But if it takes time,
I'm
not going to scream about it.
Any more discussion? Unanimous consent was asked for on this amendment. Any objections? So adopted. Is there any other discussion on this bill? Senator Halford?
One question for next year. The budget category that we're creating that's going to be in the personnel line is going to be the other 2 years of the payoff on this thing. So we just should be aware that we're going to get a non-cuttable contractual obligation in personnel line or somewhere in all the budgets next year.
Okay, just let me ask one question. Mr. Humphreys, would you come forward, please? Have you reviewed the new CS dated 424?
Yes, ma'am.
Is Section 5D not repealed?
I believe that's correct.
Yes, I did too, but I just wanted somebody to verify.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and we added your paragraph as of page 2 of your letter?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and then we added the Humphrey language on page 4, line 18, which is inserted at the rate in effect on 1186.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and then we will add the Eliason Amendment as a new CS to go. All righty, thank you. Any other discussion on this bill?
The only thing is, if I think audit should watch it, so that if there's a racket being made through some loophole, that'll be brought to our attention next year, and I would appreciate the finance chairman perhaps requesting that if they feel like they can. Otherwise, I will.
Okay. Senator Eliason?
Madam Chair, just Mr. Humphreys, if he would identify that particular...
Section 5D?
The 5D, where
it's
it is not
seven.
Repealed.
It's Section 7.
Section 7.
And the first six sections are repealed, and Section 7 is remained intact.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
If there's no other discussion, may I have a motion, please?
Chairperson.
Senator Petula.
I would move, have we adopted the committee substitute
yes,
before
sir.
Us? I would move Senate committee substitute for House Bill 382 Finance as amended out with individual recommendation.
Any objections? So moved. We will prepare a new CS then with that added amendment in for the teachers. Okay? Thank you very much. All righty. Senator Ziegler hasn't come yet. Oh. Jens, have you called Senator Ziegler? Please call.
I think Dewey would like to catch that 1045 airplane.
Would he? Let's bring up Senate Bill 209. We have an airplane trying to be caught here, an act creating the Alaska State Fire Commission, and we can always hear from Senator Ziegler. The gentleman who wishes to testify, could you come forward, please, sir? There is a proposed finance CS in our packets. Why don't we adopt that CS, Senator Sackett?
Move adoption.
It's been moved that we adopt the finance CS in our packets creating the Alaska State Fire Commission. Any objections? Okay, so adopted. Please identify yourself.
Well, my name is Dewey Wetzel. I'm president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association.
Welcome this morning, sir.
Thank
Sorry
you.
We couldn't take you yesterday.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you arranged things so that I could do this. As president of the association, I'd like to impress upon you the degree of concern that the association has for the passage of 209. You know, the members of the association, and in fact all the firefighters in the state, have throughout the years approached the fire problem, protection of lives and property, with a certain amount of frustration and our inability to turn our situation around. It only seems to grow worse. You know, finally, several years ago, you know, after everything was probably tried locally without much success, several years ago, with your help, that the Governor's Task Force on Fire Prevention and Control was established. And the study and research that followed showed a lot of the causes of the problems that we have in providing the protection.
Good morning, we were waiting for a phone call. I apologize for being
no
late.
No problem, sir. Welcome.
Some of the causes of the problems that were uncovered by the Task Force on Fire Prevention and Control, the same causes that, in fact, put the entire nation in the position of suffering the greatest losses in the industrialized world, and that the traditional 200-year-old concept that fire protection is a local responsibility, period. Going hand in hand with that, of course, is the feeling that local fire departments have of shouldering the responsibility totally for the local fire losses, and that's a reactionary type of fire protection where society, in fact, creates a problem, ask the fire service in to deal with that problem on a daily basis. You know, and if you finally want to get a handle, I guess, on the fire problem, if you finally want to try to turn the situation around, then you have to believe and act as though you believe that reactionary firefighting is a thing of the past. You know, that the problem isn't necessarily our problem, but it's your problem, it's everyone's problem, that we all have to deal with that. The task force made a recommendation on how we might be able to assume a new posture and a new approach to the problem, which is a concerted and consolidated effort by the many groups and agencies that have fire protection responsibilities, in other words, the Fire Commission. Now, we're aware of the fact that there's beginning to appear in state government a kind of a dim view of commissions, and we see that as a reaction of declining revenues, that there's a tendency to view these groups as excess baggage. And that may be true in some cases. I'm not in a position to make that kind of a judgment, but I can guarantee you in this case that that's not true. For the 17 years that I've been fighting fires in the state, this seems to be the most proactive, final good approach to solving that problem. The establishment of a fire commission is particularly important during a period of declining revenues because it's a mechanism of management and management of the resources. I've seen over the years, you have too, an incredible waste of money, duplications of effort, overlapping areas of responsibility that people can't seem to put a handle on. And we really can't afford that any longer. I think the fact is you cannot afford not to have a fire commission. I guess the word here is consolidation of effort of the different agencies that have these individual fire protection responsibilities. You've seen it work in law enforcement, and you've seen it work in emergency medical services. And I really think it's probably time to take the fire service out of the dark ages and start addressing it as a fire loss management. And it's really definitely not the time to be timid. And one last thought from the local or municipal point of view, aside from our life safety responsibilities, the primary historical responsibility of the fire service is the protection of the tax base of a community. And with declining state aid, communities are going to steadily start increasing local taxes, and we simply cannot afford the loss of important tax base. You know, the fire service can do more with less probably than any group that you know, but we need the mechanism to be able to do our jobs. And after 3 years of study by the task force, their conclusion was that the fire commission would be that kind of a mechanism. And I think that they're probably right. It seems to be the financially responsible thing to do by establishing a fire commission. Incidentally, last November 16th, at the Alaska Municipal League, through resolution, endorsed the establishment of the fire commission. And one sentence, a paragraph in that resolution was kind of interesting. I'd like you to hear it. It says, whereas, because fire protection is a business based on a cost-benefit ratio, the loss of a business in a community is more than the dollar figure attributed to the structure and its contents, but is reflected in the reduction of the tax base, the loss of jobs, and general economic slowdown in the community. There are probably 20-some agencies, state agencies, that have some fire protection responsibility. The duplication of effort oftentimes is embarrassing, but there's really, I guess, nothing that anybody presently can do about that. There are several instances that come to mind, and I'm not going to read a whole shopping list of these things, but there is one small community that got three separate grants to buy the same piece of apparatus, one from DOT, one direct legislative grant, one was from HUD. We've seen two agencies trying to do the same kinds of inspections on the same kinds of property. We've had Health and Social Services wanting to assume responsibility of hazardous materials incidences with radioactive materials, and they were totally unaware that Alaska Division of Emergency Services has the same type of people on staff and have had for years. And the list goes on and on and on. And I didn't necessarily want to get into these things unless you specifically wanted me to mention some of them. But we do believe that a fire commission is the thing to do.
Senator Ziegler, good morning, sir. Do you have a few remarks to tell the committee?
If I thought that Mr. Wetzel and I were ahead, I'd quit.
I know how busy you are.
I will say that the legislation which is before you, Senator, is modified at Senator Sackett's request, and I believe his earlier objections have been ameliorated, plus the fact that the amount of money that's been requested has been drastically reduced. I won't comment any more about the legislation itself. Mr. Wetzel, who's a pro, has already covered that, so that's it.
Any discussion? Senator Eliason?
Madam Chair, I just have one question. Page 2, it says the commission shall meet each quarter. Is that language required? Why don't we just be silent on that particular issue? Maybe they only meet once or twice a year. Should we say they have to meet each quarter?
You want to change that, Senator? There would be no objection.
Commissions have been reducing their periods of meeting because of the budget crunch.
Senator Eliason, could you point out the line? You're
line
on
seven.
Page 2, line 7.
That first sentence, the commission shall meet each quarter, I think we can probably, I would move we delete that reference to requirement to meet each quarter. If they choose to do so, they could.
Okay, it's been moved that we delete the sentence in section 44, 41, 120, part A, the commission shall meet each quarter on line 7 and 8. Any objections?
Either so, that or make it periodically, as the commission determines.
There have been no objections to that motion. That sentence has been deleted. Any other discussion or questions? Senator Sackett, you want to go over the fiscal note?
Yeah, just a comment. The monies were included in the budget under the governor's request. We took that out and attached it to this bill. It's the same dollar amount as was requested by the governor. And I'll answer any other questions you have.
There are no other questions. May I have a motion?
Move and ask unanimous consent that a finance committee substitute for Senate Bill 209 as amended or with new and redrafted be sent out of finance and judicial commission.
A new CS will be prepared incorporating the amendment we adopted. Any objections to moving the bill from committee? Hearing no objections, gentlemen, thank you very much this morning, and I hope you make your airplane.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, what I'd like to do this morning is move on to APOC, Senate Bill 356. Let's just take just a few minutes to get the packets out and the amendments.
Move all your amendments and move the bill.
That's great. I love that idea. Give them new amendments. What we've tried to do is update the amendments, show you what was adopted,
Dick,
what we revised, and what's still pending.
Fresh what? Hot coffee. Right here, yeah.
We've got it, but it's just a little bit more. They've got two AGs.
What about
Susan, could you, Ms. Burke, could you join us at the table, please?
Yes.
I thought what we'd do this morning, if there are no objections from the committee, is spend no more than 30 minutes going through these amendments this morning and get as far as we can, and then come back either this afternoon and work on the bill or Monday based on the preferences of the committee so that we could get on to hydro and could get on to tort reform. We have many people who traveled down today to testify and discuss Senate Bill 377. We'd like to give them an adequate time to testify today. If everyone has the amendments before us, Senator Sackett got me to take my amendments first. That was our first mistake. But anyway, amendment number one was adopted in part so that we did raise the $100 declaration limit up to $250. We revised amendment number two, and that is pending before us right now. I'd like to have you look at amendment number two. It has been rewritten to state, an individual who is requested to solicit a contribution for a candidate shall be appointed by the candidate as a deputy campaign treasurer. So if you ask someone to solicit funds for you, you would need to list them as a deputy treasurer. If they just bring the funds in unsolicited, they would not have to be listed.
Okay. That means requested by the candidate.
Requested by the candidate. Would someone care to move this amendment? Senator Ferguson?
I'll so move.
The amendment's been moved. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, can we adopt the amendment? Is there unanimous consent? Hearing no objections, the amendment number two is adopted. Amendment number three has been revised. Susan, would you go over amendment number three? Senator Couture, would you move amendment number three so we can have it before us for discussion?
I move amendment three.
Amendment number three has been moved. Susan?
Yes, Madam Chair. This relates to the discussion that the committee had yesterday concerning subsidiary corporations. And I was requested to try to draft the tightest sort of language that would be open to the fewest interpretations and still accomplish the result of allowing subsidiary corporations to contribute up to the maximum as well as the parent corporation. And it seemed to me that the cleanest and easiest way to do that was to simply say that a shareholder of a corporation can make a contribution up to the $1,000 maximum limit, as well as the corporation. And a shareholder obviously would include both an individual shareholder or a corporate shareholder. And that's what makes parents, corporations, parents, is the fact that they're shareholders of the subsidiary corporation. So that's what these sections do.
Senator Halford.
Madam Chair, does this mean that if a shareholder owns a majority of or the entire corporation, they can also make another contribution to the limit
without regard
to that ownership?
That's
so
what
they
it would
can,
mean.
In fact, control directly and individually more than one $1,000 limit.
You could.
Chair. What would the effect be if we adopted the amendment with, on, I think on the last section of it, unless the shareholder owns a majority of the stock of the corporation? And I don't think we should be counting shareholders as part of a corporation or minor interests as part of the same thing. But
I would have no objections to that if legal counsel says it's okay.
Well, that could be done. I think you want to make, to be careful not to put, at least in my view, not to put the burden on the candidate or the campaign officers to determine what the status of the control is of the corporation. That would be, in other words, if a shareholder of a corporation, you know, knowing that they control the corporation, makes an individual contribution and also causes the corporation to make a $1,000 contribution, then that would be a violation on the part of the shareholder. But it would not necessarily be a violation on the part of the candidate who received them unless the candidate knew or should have known under that standard.
But
a majority doesn't necessarily mean control. I mean, with some corporations, you can exercise control with much less than 50%.
5% or something.
Yeah, Susan, I have trouble with the analysis that the candidate shouldn't be responsible. Doggone it, the candidate's taking the money. I mean, they're not a helpless victim in this situation.
Well, there are situations where a candidate could be. How is a candidate supposed to know if John Smith is a majority shareholder of the XYZ Corporation?
Politicians have never known to be quiet and retiring. They could ask the question.
Well, conceivably, but in the heat of a campaign, particularly soon before the election, when checks are coming in from, one would hope, a variety of sources, I think, in my view, I mean, you know, you're much more experienced, all of you, in this than I am, because you've done it personally. It strikes me as being an unreasonable burden on the candidate and the candidate's staff to have to find out that much information about, in other words, do an independent sort of inquiry.
Senator Halford?
Just to follow that up, doesn't the way the bill is drafted say that the candidate only has any responsibility once they learn that there is a connection there, and then their responsibility is simply within 10 days from the time that they learn that to return the contribution?
That's right. And it's a no or has reason to know standard. And, you know, we intended all along that that would be a sort of object. I can't remember if I talked about this yesterday or not, a sort of objective, reasonable person standard for determining whether the candidate should have known. And as I look through the packet, Senator Sackett has offered an amendment that would make that crystal clear.
So the candidate only has the responsibility to return the contribution within 10 days of the time that they basically find out that it is a connected, directed contribution.
But the question is, you know, the question comes up if, you know, the 10 days goes by and, you know, when did the candidate know and under what circumstances should the candidate have known and those sorts of things. I mean, there are a variety of ways that you can, a variety of responsibilities that you can place on the candidate. You know, the heaviest would be to call the Division of Corporations and find out, at least on the basis of their last annual report or biennial report, what the status of the stock holdings are of the corporation. That strikes me as being pretty tough to do. And as we were talking yesterday, in lots of instances, you simply can't find that out.
Senator Fisher?
The 10 days. Let me give you an example of what would happen. Here's a candidate. Spent the money, was successful, is in office, and somebody now says the campaign's been closed out even, but, you know, in short order. Now it comes to their attention that he had 5-6 checks that would qualify under this category. What's he have to do then?
Under those circumstances, first of all, it would have to be demonstrated that the contributions violated the law in some respect. That would be for starters. In order to hold the candidate responsible and impose a fine on the candidate, it would have to be shown that the candidate either knew or, under all of the circumstances, reasonably should have known that the facts were such that those contributions violated the law.
At the time he received the contribution.
Or, I suppose, in essence, 10 days after receipt, I think.
Oh, okay, we're talking receipt.
10 days after receipt and knowledge.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, at that point, it's assumed that, you know, if you know about it and you keep it anyway, you know, you've accepted an illegal contribution.
Senator
and subject to the civil fines and civil penalties. That's one of the things. I hope everyone on the committee understands that I didn't get very far in the initial explanation because of the entire bill, but one of the major changes that this bill makes in the existing law is to remove all of the criminal penalties. It's now any violation of the present act is a misdemeanor, and yet, as I think everyone knows, there's never been a single prosecution under the act, and what we're proposing here is to put everything under the civil fine category. They just decide no.
On the amendment number 3 revised that's in your packet, there are three parts to this amendment. The third part, on page 18, line 26, I'd like the committee to deliberate my proposed amendment to that amendment. Page 18, line 26, after corporation, insert, and a contribution made by a shareholder of a corporation is not a contribution in the name of the corporation unless the shareholder owns the controlling majority of shares in that corporation. And I will repeat that.
Just one more time.
On page 18, line 26, the third part of this amendment would read, and a contribution made by a shareholder of a corporation is not a contribution in the name of the corporation, and this is the new language, unless the shareholder owns the controlling majority of shares in that corporation.
I have a question then.
Yes, sir.
Convoluted. How would it affect a contribution by British Petroleum that may, the majority of the shares are owned by the government of Great Britain, who also owns Leyland Motors, perhaps many other companies, and you can see my problem there, just as a question, it's a material, but that would create a problem that one won't really know or be able to know, potentially.
I think brother and sister corporations under this would probably be okay, unless, for instance, Leyland Motors owned a controlling interest in BP. The only time you would get a problem under this would be if the government of Great Britain also wanted to contribute to your campaign. You see what I'm saying?
Senator Elias has got the phone book of Sitka, and Senator Curtula gets the government of Great Britain. I'm feeling
bad. What about the contribution, by an MP or the Prime Minister, et cetera?
Sure. Well, those get into questions of whether the Prime Minister and the MP control the government. These control questions, your question brings up what I think everyone has figured out by now, is that this is a very complicated sort of area. And no matter what you do with it, there are going to be problems with it.
Well, British Petroleum is probably the largest socialist entity in the state in some way.
Senator Fisher?
Yes, thank you. This amendment, how is it handled for a small family corporation? Do the children get, in other words, do the parents, are they liable for the minors to say that they now own controlling interest? Let's say there could be a family of four or five people, and three of them might be minors. What happens to
that's yet another question. What is control? Under this amendment, control would be defined simply on the basis of ownership of shares, which is a legal thing that can be determined just by looking at stock certificates. So the commission would not differentiate between a small family, closely held corporation where, theoretically at least, if I'm the mom, even if I only own 5% of the shares, I might have real control over that corporation. But under this, it would be an objective standard. And, if it was 5%, then, I could make, mom's contribution and the corporation could make the corporation's contribution.
The reason I asked that is because just the other day, I guess the interpretation is now that if a minor gives, it's considered a parent donation.
That's in the pure family situation with individual contributions.
Yeah, but it doesn't apply to corporations.
No.
Is there any other discussion on Amendment Number 3 revised? Is there any objections?
If I may, just as a drafting matter, I think if you want to make the majority of the shares and controlling interest the determining factor as to whether people can make one $1,000 contribution and the corporation another, I think that same language is going to have to go in all three parts.
Senator Curtula, with your permission, we'll hold this amendment until we have it all written out correctly. I hate having complicated amendments with lots of pieces to them, amending the table without the language in front of them. I don't think that's fair. Okay, we'll hold amendment number 3 with the maker of the motion's permission. Amendment number 4 has been adopted. It wasn't written on your sheet, but that wasn't adopted, that we could have campaign funds for our office account, including travel. Amendment number 5.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Back to I'm really skeptical about when we say one thing and they interpret it as something else.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I'll give enough room to hang everybody in the state. But I guess it's a sort of a basic question. When's a candidate not a candidate?
The way we have defined candidate, a candidate is a, quote, candidate for purposes of registering under the law and having to report information to the APOC for disclosure to the public. When the candidate has received contributions from other people aggregating $1,000 or more, the theory was, at least our theory was, that you may be acting like a candidate, but as long as you're simply using your own money, which the U.S. Supreme Court has said you can spend in unlimited amounts on your own campaign, that the issue of public disclosure doesn't really come up until, number one, you officially file for office, in which case everyone would agree you were a candidate, or before you file.
When you cease to be a candidate, I guess that's the question. Is when you're sworn into office, or from then on, you're not a candidate. Is that correct?
If you lose the election, or, well, even if you lose the election for a period of, you're still subject to the laws for purposes of.
And when you're sworn into office, you cease to be a candidate.
That's correct.
So my interpretation of on page 22, section 15.14.190, my interpretation of that total section is that once you're sworn into office, you cannot do those things listed except in A5. Is that correct?
Well, you can be a candidate for purposes of re-election in one campaign and an incumbent having been elected in a different campaign. I mean, the way we set this up to be for registration purposes, you have to register, you know, when the time comes that you have to register.
Sorry. Senator Finks is a candidate, and if she is elected and she's sworn to office next January, she ceases to be a candidate, correct? Then under this amendment, she's allowed to only do Part 5A. Is that correct?
Oh, I see.
The 1, 2, 3, 4 she cannot do. Is that correct?
The introductory language is perhaps. Actually, I think you trapped me into answering the first question wrong. I'm going to go back and change my first answer.
Now, remember, you were supposed to have this written on a fifth grade level, yeah. Because if we can't understand it, I know the commissioners aren't going to understand it. I'm assuming.
Yeah. I think the term, quote, you know, when does a candidate stop being a candidate? For purposes of this bill, a candidate becomes a candidate when they register for office or when they accept contributions for a particular campaign. They stop being a candidate for that campaign when they've done all the things that have to be done and they are no longer subject to any of the things that are in this bill with respect to that campaign or those campaign funds.
So your answer would be Senator Thanks could not, after she swore in office, could not donate funds from her campaign to a charitable organization. She could not donate funds to the general fund of the state, or she could not do those other things because she has ceased to be a candidate. She is a public official. The only thing she can do is what this Amendment 4 allows her to do. Is that my correct interpretation of that?
Well, that is certainly not what was intended.
But could that be interpreted that way?
I don't think it could, no. It wouldn't make sense in terms of the overall context of the legislation.
Well, then why did we adopt Amendment 4?
Because there is another section in the bill that says a candidate may only use campaign funds for certain limited purposes, which are to influence the outcome of an election. That's what that amendment was for.
You see what I'm...
Yeah, I understand.
Am I missing something here?
No.
Or it seems to me that we're saying that a candidate can dispose of campaign funds. Okay, you're a candidate until you're sworn in office. At that particular time, are we still candidates after sworn in office? Can we dispose of surplus campaign funds by giving it to charities? It's not clear to me. I don't know if it's going to be clear to the commission.
I think I'd have to check the dates, but I think in terms of the date that campaigns, accounts have to be terminated, and the time after which, after, you know, that surplus funds have to be disposed of, that you will not have been sworn into office under the dates in this bill. So I don't think the question will arise.
You have to do all of these things by December 31st of the campaign year. We adopted that yesterday. What I'm saying, in another section of the bill, it says once you're a candidate, you can do all these things with your campaign funds. My problem was, what is if you're an incumbent and a candidate at the same time? I've written this and asked the Ethics Committee for a clarification on this point, but I thought as long as the bill was sailing through, we could clarify the point in the legislation.
So for example, I have some campaign funds left over at the present time. Mm-hmm. I'm not a candidate. Can I contribute those funds to the general fund of the state of Alaska, or can I donate to a charitable organization under this bill?
Under present law, you can do whatever you like with
those.
This is
past. Can I do it, though?
No.
I can't.
Well, wait a minute. You're only going to have surplus campaign funds under this for a very, very, very short period of time. You've got to get your campaign accounts entirely closed, all checks written, including checks for surplus funds, by December 31st. That's well before you're sworn into office.
Then the surplus funds can be transferred to another account, is that what you're saying?
They could be then transferred to your office account. You can donate them to charity. You can do any of the things with them that are among the items that are listed.
And if you neglect to do that before that,
you're subject to a penalty under the statute.
Oh, if it's still sitting in the account, then you can't do anything with it then. You can't contribute. If you miss that deadline under this law, you cannot do anything with that account.
No,
except,
the account must be closed.
Except for...
No, what Senator Eliason is suggesting is that if you miss all of the deadlines and you wait until after you're sworn into office, for one thing, I think that would be an absurd result that I think even the APOC would seek to avoid. It wouldn't make any sense for you, for the surplus funds to remain in limbo simply because the candidate was sworn into office before they were disposed of. The person would be subject to a fine under the civil penalties for...
I could
for
see
late
the APOC
disposal.
Taking the entire campaign fund, though.
All they can do is impose fines. They can't seize the money.
Oh, they can't seize the money? But they could impose the fine equal to the amount of money.
That's correct.
Plus attorney fees.
Okay. Senator Fisher?
Just on the same line of questioning, let's say we have a House member, successful, he's got $10,000 left in the account, and he's sworn in, he decides he's going to run the next election. So before December, or I mean, even before he's sworn in, he files, I'm going to run in next 2 years from now. Can he just transfer that money over to his next account since he's going to be?
Yes.
He can.
That's under sub 3, page 23, line 6. After registering with the commission, transferring it to the new campaign.
So you then... keep all the money anyhow because you just file for the next election right away and you've got your fund already set up for the
But you can only use those funds for running for that office. I mean, if you've got them in, and if you don't use them or you decide not to file, they become surplus funds. And, you know, you can either keep doing that again, but there's going to be little purpose in just rolling that money over and over again.
You have before you Amendment Number 5. It's been revised. Amendment Number 5 is the selection process of how ACOC board members are selected. If you remember yesterday, I told you that we did have trouble clearly delineating how a new member, a vacancy, is filled after ACOC was formed. Amendment Number 5 has been revised and adopted with the permission of the committee. I will move that amendment. I think it's eminently clear now. Mr. Bradley, I think you did a nice job spelling it out in fifth grade language. Are there any objections? Yes.
No objection, just one quick question. Constitutionally,
okay.
We can do this. In other words, the governor does not have to appoint that member. That, according to our Constitution, I thought you couldn't do this.
There are constitutional questions with this. They have been finessed, avoided by comedy and agreement over the years. Our thinking in trying to deal with this section was there were enough difficult, controversial areas in this bill, as we've all seen, that we didn't want to mess with this one, and we thought it was better. It's worked reasonably well. How we can do it in a way that will make sense. I'm not saying it's unconstitutional. I'm saying there are some questions about it. There, I see some overriding interests on the other side with regard to, you know, trying to keep the bipartisan nature of the commission.
So. Do we need a severability clause in this?
No. There's already a severability statute that in the statutes that would govern. I don't think that's a problem.
Any objections to the adoption of revised amendment number 5? Here.
I only object for purposes of noting that I may have an amendment later when my turn comes, that's all.
Wonderful. Hearing no objections, amendment number 5 will be adopted. Amendment number 6, we've adopted already. Amendment number 7, you've got a big X, and I have a new amendment number 6, 7. This is the $100, the lack of cash contributions amendment. Mr. Bradley did redo it, so that it's the fundraiser exemption. Mr. Bradley, will you come forward, please, sir? Okay, what this amendment does, and it says Bradley number 1 is the new number 7. It's a separate document. Everybody got it? Okay. This eliminates cash contributions totally, except for the spaghetti fee of Senator Halperts. Could you talk about that, Mr. Bradley?
Where this is different from the earlier version is in the addition of the material on page 2 of my draft, the new section 1514-155, and with, except as provided in that section, phrases dropped in to deal with the general prohibitions that exist right now.
Senator Halper, do you have any problems with that?
Is there, let's see.
Let me say, ma'am, if I may, that the Commission's regulation on this subject goes on for about 3 columns of print in the regulations. And I started from that, but I abbreviated it substantially. For example, the Commission talks about a lot of different kinds of fundraisers. I did not deal with that question.
I think it deals with the question I have, but I'm not. 3 pages. Does it provide for individual accounting of these contributions?
I note there's apparently a typo. This was done awfully quickly. We went through 4 drafts before it got sent over to you. On the 3rd amendment on page 1, the citation should be 1514-155 rather than 150D.
Say that again, Mr. Bradley. On page 1.
The 3rd amendment.
On page 12, line 13.
Yes.
Okay.
The citation should be.
The citation in subsection 7. Remember,
right.
This is all being recorded, so we want to do this very plainly.
That's
for
right.
Each fundraiser held under AS 1514.
155.
155.
Which is the section on the next page that's added.
Okay. Everybody at the committee have that? Senator Halper, any other questions on that? Does that cover your problem? Senator Halper, if you'd like more time, we can hold this amendment.
I think it does cover it, but I just...
I will be happy to hold the amendment, sir. We're not going to get through all of these today anyway. Would you prefer that?
Yeah.
Okay, no problem at all. All right, we'll hold that amendment. Amendment number 8. Amendment number 8, the current bill, the way it's drafted, it's my understanding, Susan, that it prohibits talking about campaign contributions in any public building or running around collecting contributions.
Soliciting
contributions. But there are regularly scheduled meetings of, say, employee groups in public buildings. And in the course of the meeting, the PAC, the employee PAC, could be and is usually discussed. This amendment would allow for the PAC to be discussed in regularly scheduled meetings of a labor union or whoever's representing the public employees in a state building or municipal building. Did I state it correctly?
Absolutely.
Are there any questions? I'll move amendment number 8. Questions or discussion? To me, this is a logical amendment. It makes eminent sense. It's ridiculous to, in a regular scheduled meeting, not to be able to bring up a normal course of business. Any objections to the amendment? We'll adopt amendment number 8 then. Thank you. Amendment number 9. Susan, I will move this amendment, and then you're going to have to talk about it.
Page 14.
Amendment number 9 is, yeah, page 14, after line 7, insert.
With your permission, Madam Chair, this was one of the amendments that Mr. Bradley drafted, and I think I would just assume
great
have him explain it, since he wrote it.
Well, I have forgotten what I was trying to achieve here. I'm sorry.
Me too. That's why I wanted you to do it.
Me too. That's why I wanted him to do it.
I mean, I assume it speaks for itself, but...
No, it doesn't. Oh, I remember. Got it. All right. What has come to our attention is that some candidates or some incumbents are able to raise a lot more money than others, and they are then able to purchase campaign paraphernalia or printing or signs or whatever for other candidates. And this amendment says that if you get a receipt, that receipt must have on it the reasons for that expenditure. This may simply be too convoluted to work, but it was an attempt to fill a loophole so that everyone knows who's spending money for whom and for what. Susan? Yeah.
Madam Chair, I don't know whether the provision that in the bill that I'm about to describe would adequately take care of this problem. In the expenditure reports that have to be filed along with the contribution reports, it is required that the purpose of the expenditure be included. Whether that's enough to, conceivably, I suppose someone could say, quote, media, and it wouldn't indicate who the media was for. Okay. But
I would like to withdraw amendment number 9. I just don't think it does what we want it to do. Is there any objections from the committee? Oh, great. We'll withdraw amendment number 9. Now, we have still pending amendment number 3 and amendment from Mr. Bradley. No. Yes, and the amendment from Mr. Bradley and Senator Sackett's amendments. With the committee's permission, may we take this bill up again at 1:30 today? Any problems so we can get on to hydro? Senator?
Are we just about through with the bill after those amendments?
We have Senator Sackett's
amendments. We have Senator Sackett's amendments, hopefully, unless others of you have amendments.
I have one amendment.
Oh, it's Senator Tula's amendment.
So
maybe... Maybe this afternoon for 45 minutes or an hour we could get this bill out. Okay, we'll put the bill back on. Is that all right with you, Senator Weiss? I know you won't be here.
It's fine.
Okay. Hydroelectric bill.
How many of them are we actually picking?
Okay, let's do Senate Bill 468. 468. You have proposed finance CS in front of you, and the only difference between this finance CS and the original bill introduced by this committee is that this committee introduced a bill setting up both the Energy Fund and the Energy Council, and the House has already passed the Energy Fund portion. So we eliminated the Energy Fund portion from this bill because the House has already passed it, and we have that House bill with us in House Bill 699. So, could we have a motion to adopt?
I so move.
The CS for Senate Bill 468 Finance has been adopted, setting up the Rail Belt Energy Council. Is Mr. Heath with us? Commissioner, could you come forward, please, sir, and give us your feelings on this Energy Council and the administration's feelings on it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Heath, Director of the APA. Madam Chair, we have no problem with the concept of the Energy Council. We do have a question in the sense that they're charged with some very heavy responsibilities without funding and staff. This is our big concern, is will they be able to spend the time and the money necessary to accomplish these tasks with
Senator, Senator Kutula?
They testified that they are willing to do it collectively because the pot at the end of the rainbow is $268 million for key energy producing and production for the area. And so there's a lot of interest in spending whatever is necessary to put together a rail belt energy plan that the user groups can then put in place. And I think that's that's the carrot, and that's the reason I believe they'll do it. You may have another, you may be able to plug holes into that thought, but that's what, you know, that's what we got.
It's my impression, sir, they'd like the opportunity to give it a go. And so we gave them their mission, and we asked them questions that we'd like to know, and hopefully we'll get a good work product from them.
Madam Chair, I really, we have no objection. We just question, will they be able to accomplish this?
Well, with $1 billion down, we just didn't feel like we could give them any specific sums of money. Senator Ferguson?
Yes. I have a memorandum from Mayor Tony Knowles. On the second page, first paragraph, he states, first, the conference supported state action to establish an advisory group for the fund to include participation by the state administration, the legislature, and all the rail belt utilities. And if we want the advisory group to make a recommendation without APA, then the utilities, GT cooperatives, should be utilized. Otherwise, this rail belt council is a duplication of APA's statutory responsibility. And my question to Bob is, do you have that statutory capability right now?
Madam Chair, I believe we have the statutory capability, but we have been accused many times, Senator, of not cooperating fully with the utilities. And if this be a mechanism whereby they can more fully participate, I really can't argue with it in that sense. I would hope that a mechanism can be worked out whereby they will be participatory in a much bigger sense than this proposes. In other words, I would very much like to have a utility representative sitting in my office on a daily basis so they can go through, as presuming go down through these studies, they can look at them, they can ask the questions of the contractors, and then report back to the board. If this works as a once a month or a twice a month, a once every 2 months meeting group, I don't think it'll work because the information simply won't get to them. APA will make a presentation over a three-hour period, and it won't work unless they are willing to get truly involved.
Well, Mr. Heath, we're giving them that opportunity. I guess if we pass this bill, the ball will be in their court, and we'll see how they deliver.
Okay.
Any more questions on the bill? Senator Lyson?
Well, I just want to express some concern in as much as that the bill focuses naturally on the rail, but there's very little opportunity for other people who are not living in that area to participate in this energy program. I think that it would strengthen it by having people from all over the state rather than just that particular area, because we are dealing with monies that belongs to all the people of the state of Alaska. So I guess I'm expressing some concern. There's very little, if any, representation from the rural areas or southeastern Alaska in this bill.
We thought it was a rail belt energy council for that particular portion, southeast, Sitka, and the coast, received $500 million in energy that I realize there's an APA involvement in some of it. But there is, this is just intending to be a rail belt utilization group meeting to make a decision on how to accommodate just less than their proportionate portion of the funds that were allocated for energy. This is rail belt energy money. I don't object to others sitting in, but I certainly would object to others being in control in any way of it. And we've already seen how one person southeastern, right from downtown Juneau, could completely screw up a project. So,
is there any other discussion on the bill?
Well, may I respond to that?
Senator,
I might remind Senator Katula that the communities in southeast Alaska, when built these electrical projects, the participation was fully from other areas of the state. It wasn't just Southeast representation on the construction of those particular facilities. What I'm saying is that it might be prudent for us to open the door to allow some input from other parts of the state rather than just the rail belt. I'm not suggesting that we weigh it in favor of any particular area in Southeast or the rural area, but I think there should be somebody on that board who is at least represents other areas of Alaska rather than a rail belt.
Well, Senator Lyson, the governor has that opportunity. He has two members that he can appoint, and both the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House has got two appointees, and I would think they would have that ability.
I'm only expressing my concern over the lack of accommodating other areas of state.
Any other discussion on the bill? Senator Ferguson?
if we have committee substitute percentage bill number 477 to go along with this, I don't have any problem with your counsel if that's what rail bill feels is important, but I think it's important that we get 477.
I'm going to try in just a few minutes. May I have a motion on 468 finance? Senator Petula?
I so move.
Senate Bill 468 finance has been moved from the committee with individual recommendations, sir?
With individual recommendations, excuse me.
Any objections? So moved. Great. Senate Bill 476. Okay, Mr. Heath, you have a sectional analysis. You have a finance CS in this that Commissioner Heath has been working on. There have been a few changes from the original finance bill that was introduced to the committee. We have softened some of the rather critical analysis of APA that I don't think the majority of us feel. There is a sectional analysis in your bill. Mr. Heath, you might wish to address finance CS dated 4/23/86.
Madam Chair, we have read this, and I would agree that perhaps some of the language, it has been softened from its original language. Perhaps, given time, I might have asked for more softening, but the intent and the net result of the bill is we can certainly favor.
Great. I was up this morning in the governor's office with the chief of staff, and they also had no expressed objections with the bill and were pleased that the bill had been revised and softened somewhat.
Yes.
Could I have a motion to adopt the CS? There's been a motion to adopt the CS dated 4/23/86. Any objections? So moved. Any discussion on the bill? The bill is Senator Halpert.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that and we get at least a preliminary plan of finance before anything goes any further.
That is the whole point of the deal, that the plan of finance, Mr. Heath, is my understanding, is number one.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Heath is nodding his head yes, that before anything else goes forward, before any additional money is spent, the preliminary plan of finance or plan of finance must be at the top of the agenda. There has been a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Senator Olson.
I don't have any reference in my folder at all to what we're repealing. There's no, there are some repealers in the bill. I don't have any reference to what those repealers are, except in the sectional analysis. Maybe somebody could address those.
Commissioner?
I cannot address directly the repealers. I think perhaps...
Mr. Zenich, would you come forward, please? Mr. Zenich is the executive director of the Senate Advisory and is a hydroelectric expert. Mr. Zenich, would you talk about the repealers and address Senator Elias's question?
Well, I haven't had a chance to really look at the switch. The repealer are you addressing particularly?
Well, there's Section 9 is a repealer, Section 10 is a repealer.
There were two items that were repealed. One was the authorization of the Watana Dam, which was done about a year ago by the previous legislature, which authorized the construction of Watana Dam at $3 billion.
Okay.
That's being repealed.
Okay.
The other repealer is the requirement to do a reconnaissance study for Devil Canyon or any other project that's on the Susitna River. And the reason that's being repealed is because even before the state got involved with that project, the Corps of Engineers were already into feasibility level studies. We have, of course, spent $145 million have a FERC license feasibility study, numerous studies. And so to go back all the way back to square one and start with reconnaissance level studies would be sort of reinventing the wheel.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Hoffert?
Yeah, I just want to make sure from both Kurt and from the Power Authority that this preliminary plan of finance precedes a feasibility study and major reconnaissance so that if we look at an alternative or at Devil Canyon, that we know that the utilities are willing to at least talk about conditional power sales agreements based on X initial threshold number being the cost before we spend the money. We know what we got in our checkbook, what the basic parameters are, and we don't spend any money studying either Devil Canyon or alternatives until we have commitments from the utilities that they want to go forward and we have a preliminary plan of finance that says X amount of dollars are going to be required as the state's portion of it, X amount are going to be required as the utilities portion, and then we go forward.
Well, as you are probably aware, the APA board at its last meeting was discussing the request for proposal. And that request for proposal was going to be managed by a steering committee. Now, at the initial board meeting, the steering committee was made up of APA and utilities. I don't know what is happening to that. Maybe Bob can indicate what the latest thinking on this. But they were going to be involved with management of this proposal.
Madam Chair?
Commissioner?
To the best of our ability, we will invite the utilities to participate as fully as they choose to in selection and going through the process of looking at these alternatives.
But my point is, if they don't come forward and participate on a preliminary plan of finance, then there's no sense coming up with a feasibility study to do something that nobody's going to agree to do anyway.
Hear, hear.
Madam Chair, there was no intent, in my mind at least, to go to a feasibility level study. These would all be preliminary type looks and reviews of what has already been done, not starting over and building something that hasn't been done before, with one minor exception, and I should mention it, is I believe that we should look at a holding pond, let's call it, upstream of Devil's Canyon. I believe that should be looked at as a possibility.
Well, I don't care what you look at, as long as you don't look at anything that you haven't got a preliminary plan of finance for. The plan of finance should come first before we spend the money on extensive feasibility.
Madam Chair?
Well, you have to know what you're going to have a finance plan for. You have to know what the thing looks like before you can figure out how to finance it, Senator Halbert.
We have spent
the question of the
fortune
AD.
On...
Yeah. But you still have to know whether you've got a coal plant or a hydro plant before you can go finance it.
But unless the utilities are willing to say that they'll come forward and look at conditional power sales agreements on X amount of power at X cost, it doesn't matter whether it comes from coal, hydro, gas, or anything else.
Well, that's correct. You're right on that. But to say they can't go out and go look at something, I think is going one way too far.
Well, I think the preliminary plan of finance requires an assessment of a general idea and cost and so forth. But it's different than a feasibility study. A feasibility, you know, we've got projects that are feasible if we use the permanent fund. Well, that's not feasible. And there's no sense going forward on a feasibility study that's not there. And that's an extensive process and costs a lot of money, where the preliminary plan of finance is a relatively inexpensive process, and that should be the threshold screen before we spend the feasibility money. That's all I'm saying.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I can respond. Senator, I understand what you're saying. But, you know, the first step is you've got to find out a good estimate with an orders, not orders of magnitude, but a reasonable estimate of what the project's going to cost and what it will produce. Not a feasibility study, but just an estimate of what it will cost. And will the utilities buy it? Do they need it? And then you can go into a plan of finance. I just want to make that. I think we're talking the same thing.
Okay.
Senator Sackett?
No.
Senator Lyson?
I was wondering, it seems to me that couldn't you approach it from the other way, finding out what the utilities are willing to pay for projects, and then develop the cost of the project, then go out and look for something that fits that cost. I think that's what you're saying, isn't it? That rather than spend an extensive amount of funds studying something and find out at the end of the road that you don't have the ability to finance it because utilities have been left behind.
Yeah, well, I want the utilities in up front.
Start up front, and then whatever, then they can develop, they can know what their abilities are to finance. And you can have the amount of money that's you could. Beyond that, it's not feasible. So once you start with that known, then you can go out and find whether it's going to be gas or oil or hydro, whatever it might be. It seems to me that would be the prudent way of doing it.
I think we're all saying that. Yeah, I think we're...
There is a motion to move the committee bill, Senate Bill 476, finance out of the committee with individual recommendations. Any objections? Bill so moved. Let's put the rest of the hydro bills on the burner until this afternoon, and let's bring up the tort reform bill, Senate Bill 377, because we're going to lose Senator Eliason, and I'd like him to go over what he did with his proposed finance CS, Senator Sackett, your staff did a beautiful job on an analysis, on a comparison analysis between the Labor and Commerce version, the Judiciary version, and the Finance version.
My staff.
Oh,
Chair.
Not your staff?
Senator Lyson's staff.
That's what I thought I said. What did I say? Senator Sackett.
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator. Quiet in the room. We are still meeting, please. Senator Elias and your staff did a beautiful job in this comparison. It's easy to understand. It shows all three versions of the bill out. Okay, very good. And would Senator Elias, before you have to leave us for this afternoon, I'd like you to have an opportunity to go ahead and give us your feelings on the bill and what you tried to do. And
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Actually, I didn't have extensive exposure to tort reform. I've been, I think, attended about two or three public hearings on the issue, one in Anchorage and a couple here in Juneau as a member of the Labor and Commerce Committee. But what we did is the proposed draft before you is an accumulation of different views on the issue. The particular bill I have there is I support generally. I think the thrust, more or less, is along the lines of the tort reform group who's organized throughout Alaska. Obviously, there's going to be some things in there that's going to be offensive to certain groups of people. However, I might stress it just a starting point. I think that once we get into the bill, we can be let down through the different meanings of what it does, and we can make our determination based upon the testimony. It's something to work from. And you have the reference to the different approaches on the analysis that my staff worked up. So, you know, that's where we're starting.
Well, it's a beautiful job, Senator Lyson. I really appreciate it because it's very clear and concise and spells it right out. Is there someone here, sir, that you would like to give a general overview of the issue and to talk about the finance CS?
We have, I think, Dick.
Would you like Dr. McGuire to go first?
Okay.
May we ask a question?
You sure may. And Dr. McGuire, what I'm going to allow the committee to do, we have about 10 minutes before we have to leave this morning for floor action. We will take this bill up again at 1:30 today. So if you could begin, and then there may be some questions for you this morning.
We have the woolly mammoth.
I have a few remarks that I'd like to make. I'd be happy to save those to later and talk about the specific points of the bill or make those remarks and come back to the specific points of the bill, whatever you're choosing.
Would the committee like to hear Dr. McGuire's general remarks first this morning and then ask questions this afternoon, or ask questions now and hear his remarks this morning, or hear, have him answer questions this morning?
We won't have time for questions.
Okay, why don't you begin your remarks?
The issue before us then is the one of tort reform versus whether or not the problem with the liability insurance availability, affordability, etc., is the result of the machinations of the insurance company. And so what the legislators then are being asked to decide is this issue strictly the result of collusive practices, predatory pricing, etc., on the part of the insurance company, or is there indeed something amiss with our tort system? And so if you take the view that it's the entire fault of the insurance company, then it seems to me and others that there are some basic questions that need to be answered. And if I may bring those to your attention. The first of those questions would be, if it's entirely the fault of the insurance companies, why is it that our present tort system is so inefficient? One-third of the dollars that go into the system end with the victim. Two-thirds go somewhere else. And there are innumerable citations. For example, on page 42 of the tort liability or the tort policy working group, the asbestosis claims are shown to have returned only 37 cents of all the dollars that were put in there. Only 37 cents ended with the victims of asbestosis. So saying that the insurance companies are at fault doesn't explain this apparently very inefficient mechanism. Now, if we say that the whole crisis is caused by the insurance company's greed, predatory pricing, the profit motive, etc., then why is it that people who don't deal with insurance in the first issue, those self-insured persons, if they look at their first dollar loss coverage, they track in parallel what the insurance companies are telling us? The point of it is that they're losing money to this tort system at the same rate that the insurance companies tell us they're losing. The second is that those companies that are nonprofit, for example, MICA, have the same parallel loss experience. So you see, it doesn't seem logical that the whole explanation is the greed on the part of the insurance companies. A few other facts and questions. If it's the fault of the insurance companies entirely, why is it that the number of product liability suits has increased 758% in 11 years in the federal tort system? Why have the number of lawsuits per 100 doctors in this country doubled between 1979 and 1983 if the entire problem is with the pricing of the insurance companies? And why have they tripled for obstetricians and gynecologists? Why have the average awards for product liability across the country gone from 390,000 approximate to 1.8 million in the same period of time? The malpractice awards have gone from 220,000 to 1 million in the same period of time. Now, it seems to me that you can't invoke the greed of the insurance companies to explain those facts. Now, there's been contention that this is a nationwide problem and that it doesn't affect Alaska. But if I may, bring to you from the Superior Court records the filings in the state of Alaska. On average, these filings, total cases, have increased approximately 30% from, in 1983, total filings were 18,364. Now, these are according to the court records. In 1985, they were 21,626. But in the same period of time, the number of civil damage cases went from 1,038 to 2,096. That's over 100% increase. Now, how is it that the number of civil damage filings should increase 100% in our own state of Alaska if the whole problem is the fault of the insurance companies? We would submit to you that the insurance companies may not be innocent. We are not their lobby. But it isn't sufficient to say that this entire crisis is created by the insurance company unless we find some reasonable explanation for these facts that I've attempted to point out to you. It is our contention that there may indeed be two problems. But in and of itself, our tort system needs reform. And the proposals that have been put forward in this draft, which we would support, I think are excellent. I'd be happy to answer specific questions regarding these if there's time.
Is it my understanding that you would support the Senate finance version that Senator Eliason has prepared?
That's correct.
What about the Senate Labor and Commerce version?
We would prefer this version.
And the Senate Judiciary version?
We would prefer this version.
Okay. All right. Questions for Dr. McGuire, and I would like to note for the room that the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court is with us this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, sir.
Good to see you. Senator Sackett?
Why?
Why do we support this version as opposed to the other? Well, if I may make one general comment, and that is that what we're talking about is a comprehensive solution to the tort problem. And so to do just minor repairs are simply not going to work. So if we want to go point by point and discuss which of these work and don't work, if I may leave arbitration for a minute, I'm referring now to a comparison of SB 377 tort reform provided by Senator Eliason's staff, the working number. If we look at Senate Judiciary and non-economic damages, the Senate Judiciary Committee set no limit whatever. No, it's our contention that the problem with non-economic damages is that they are not measurable by any rational means. One. Two, that we have unknowingly or unknowingly created two classes of citizens, really. Those citizens who are injured and have no one to sue, and those who are injured and have someone to sue. And the simple example is, if you're run over by a truck and you're paralyzed, you may sue the trucking company for $1 million. If you are the innocent bystander in a 7-Eleven or other store, when somebody comes in and holds them up and you get shot and you're paralyzed, you don't have anybody to sue and your pain and suffering is just as bad, you're just as paralyzed, but you don't end up with $1 million. So if our intent as a society is to compensate the victims of injuries, then perhaps we should enact legislation that compensates every victim of every injury and compensates them equally. It's unreasonable that on the one hand we have the fortunate, unfortunate few who can get $1 million because there's somebody with a deep pocket. On the other hand, we have individuals who are equally as unfortunate and they get nothing except perhaps whatever money's left in the victims of violent crime, etc. So
Excuse me, Senator Halford, do you have a question on this non-economics? Okay.
What is the total paid in non-economic damages in the state last year, for example?
I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Is that something we can get? I mean, that would be important to try to understand the significance of a limitation on non-economic damages, I would think.
I could make one observation. It's common sense is not common, and it's dangerous to rely on it, but sometimes it's helpful. The individual who sued the hospital for and was awarded a judgment for $1 million, $600,000 of which was for non-economic damages due to loss of psychic powers from a CAT scan. Now, you don't have to extend that analogy too much.
Is this an Alaska case?
I'm sorry?
Is this an Alaska case?
No.
Is that itemized, non-economic damages? Is that itemized?
It's under one lump sum. It's called pain and suffering.
Right. See, so it's difficult, Senator Halford, to get some definitive numbers when they don't itemize it that way.
Well,
what you're asking me for,
the bill,
if I understand your question, are there specific cases in Alaska that we can bring to you that show that non-economic damages are large awards?
Well, yeah, but what I'd like to know is what's the significance overall. Are most of the awards economic damages, or is 10%, 5%, 50% of the total awards that are going out based on non-economic damages, based on economic damages? Even if you just limit it to medical malpractice that you're more familiar with, how's it break down?
I think that someone more familiar with the insurance industry could answer that question. Perhaps Mr. Block could give you information on that. It depends. It very much depends on the case.
With that, gentlemen, I'd like to call the meeting. We will hold the meeting in recess until 1:30 this afternoon. And because we have floor action, we could not get delayed today. So we need to go to the floor. Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair, I'd like to, if we have time, bring up the student loan bill.
You got it. Okay. Thank you, Senator. Senator, will your office then take the responsibility of notifying those people who would be interested in coming to hear? Great. Thank you. Meeting recessed until 1:30. Thank you, everybody.